Državni izpitni center.
Maturità generale 2017. A tutti voi un cordiale saluto. Siamo all'inizio della prova d'ascolto d'inglese. Questa prova d'esame si compone di due parti, la parte A e la parte B. Per ciascuna parte ascolterete un testo e risponderete poi ad un esercizio che a esso si ricollega. Dapprima leggerete l'esercizio, poi ascolterete ciascun testo per due volte e risolverete l'esercizio durante l'ascolto. L'inizio e la fine del testo saranno indicati dal seguente segnale acustico. Scrivete le vostre risposte negli spazi appositamente previsti all'interno della prova, utilizzando la penna stilografica o la penna sfera. Scrivete in modo leggibile e ortograficamente corretto. In caso di errore, tracciate un segno sulla risposta scorretta e scrivete accanto ad essa quella corretta. Alle risposte e alle correzioni scritte in modo leggibile verranno assegnati 0 punti. Abbiate fiducia in voi stessi e nelle vostre capacità. Vi auguriamo buon lavoro. Ascoltate con attenzione. Aprite la prova d'esame.
Section A. You will hear an interview with Anna Broinowski, a filmmaker. You will hear the recording twice. Now read the task.
Meet Anna Broinowski, a documentary maker from Australia, who set herself the challenge of making a film inside the world's most secretive state, North Korea. Her subject was the country's surprisingly rich movie industry. Communist North Korea is pretty much cut off from the outside world, and the regime uses film as a propaganda tool to indoctrinate the population about the decadence of other countries. So the cinema industry is very important. Anna was allowed to spend 3 weeks with the country's top directors and actors back in 2012. She's now written a book about the experience and made a film. Speaking to Outlook from her home in Sydney, Anna told me what gave her the idea in the first place.
Very strange birthday present for my 40th. A friend is a producer. She'd just come back from Pyongyang, where she'd been making something on human rights abuses in North Korea, and gave me Kim Jong-il's manifesto on how to make the perfect propaganda movie as a kind of joke.
Kim Jong-il was the previous leader, the father of the current leader of North Korea.
Yeah, correct. Kim Jong-il was a massive film buff, and his manifesto basically set out his methodology for making the perfect socialist propaganda movie. And when I started to read it, I thought it would just be a bit of a joke. I was prepared to have a kind of laugh at the dear leader's expense. But the more I read what he was writing, the more I became very fascinated by, you know, this kind of obvious tension in the text between his love, his obvious love of Hollywood movies, and his mission as the dictator of the last so-called pure socialist nation on earth to destroy capitalism forever.
He sounds a bit like a frustrated film director, really.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in the more I read of what he'd written, and he wrote in literature and ballet, and certainly, you know, there were 20,000 odd Western movies that he kept in a vacuum-sealed vault in Pyongyang, and his favourite filmmakers were Spielberg, he loved James Bond, and every film Elizabeth Taylor had ever starred in. Mm. He was kind of like a frustrated artist who got the wrong job in a way.
And around the same time as you were reading this book and discovering all this, you were worrying about plans to do coal seam mining or fracking in a park in Sydney. And this book gave you an idea.
Yes, it did. So originally I was going to make a totally different film about this coal seam gas mine that had been planned for Sydney Park or near Sydney Park, you know, less than 5 minutes walk from where my kid goes to school and where I live, and everything I'd read about fracking and coal seam gas mining and unconventional gas drilling filled me with horror. So I was going to make a straight documentary. But then as I was reading Kim Jong-il's manifesto, I was sort of familiarizing myself with his rules. And I started to think, wouldn't it be fun to take his rules and follow them? That's how coal seam gas and Kim Jong-il ended up in the same movie.
Was this your cover story for getting into North Korea? Or was this a genuine project that you wanted?
Now you will hear the recording again.
Meet Anna Bronowski, a documentary maker from Australia, who set herself the challenge of making a film inside the world's most secretive state, North Korea. Her subject was the country's surprisingly rich movie industry. Communist North Korea is pretty much cut off from the outside world, and the regime uses film as a propaganda tool to indoctrinate the population about the decadence of other countries. So the cinema industry is very important. Anna was allowed to spend 3 weeks with the country's top directors and actors back in 2012. She's now written a book about the experience and made a film. Speaking to Outlook from her home in Sydney, Anna told me what gave her the idea in the first place.
Very strange birthday present for my 40th. A friend is a producer. She'd just come back from Pyongyang, where she'd been making something on human rights abuses in North Korea, and gave me Kim Jong-il's manifesto on how to make the perfect propaganda movie as a kind of joke.
Kim Jong-il was the previous leader, the father of the current leader of North Korea.
Yeah, correct. Kim Jong-il was a massive film buff, and his manifesto basically set out his methodology for making the perfect socialist propaganda movie. And when I started to read it, I thought it would just be a bit of a joke. I was prepared to have a kind of laugh at the dear leader's expense. But the more I read what he was writing, the more I became very fascinated by, you know, this kind of obvious tension in the text between his love, his obvious love of Hollywood movies, and his mission as the dictator of the last so-called pure socialist nation on earth to destroy capitalism forever.
He sounds a bit like a frustrated film director, really.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in the more I read of what he'd written, and he wrote in literature and ballet, and certainly, you know, there were 20,000 odd Western movies that he kept in a vacuum-sealed vault in Pyongyang, and his favourite filmmakers were Spielberg, he loved James Bond, and every film Elizabeth Taylor had ever starred in. Mm. He was kind of like a frustrated artist who got the wrong job in a way.
And around the same time as you were reading this book and discovering all this, you were worrying about plans to do coal seam mining or fracking in a park in Sydney. And this book gave you an idea.
Yes, it did. So originally I was going to make a totally different film about this coal seam gas mine that had been planned for Sydney Park or near Sydney Park, you know, less than 5 minutes walk from where my kid goes to school and where I live, and everything I'd read about fracking and coal seam gas mining and unconventional gas drilling filled me with horror. So I was going to make a straight documentary. But then as I was reading Kim Jong-il's manifesto, I was sort of familiarizing myself with his rules. And I started to think, wouldn't it be fun to take his rules and follow them? That's how coal seam gas and Kim Jong-il ended up in the same movie.
Was this your cover story for getting into North Korea? Or was this a genuine project that you wanted?
This is the end of Section A. Section B. You will hear an interview with Ruth Rogers, the chef. You will hear the recording twice. Now read the task. Oh.
My castaway this week is the chef and restaurateur Ruth Rogers. The River Cafe, the culinary institution she heads, is revered by foodies and chefs the world over and has been going strong for more than a quarter of a century. Along with her dear friend and business partner, the late Rose Gray, she rewrote not just the menu, but also the rulebook of what it means to dine out well. Forget glossy reductions, timbales or sugar spun nests, and think instead of the very finest ingredients prepared with rustic sentiment and unyielding rigour, served up in a minimalist space in a decidedly unglamorous part of town. She is by nature a perfectionist, sleeping overnight in far-flung Italian bakeries to better understand how loaves are made, or traipsing the length and breadth of the same country every November to find just the right olive oil to drizzle on wood-roasted turbot or chopped raw veal. Her Michelin star and cult status are all the more impressive, given that she never set out to be a chef. She arrived from America at the tail end of the 60s, studying graphic art and falling in love with a young architect who would later go on to design her now world-renowned restaurant. His name was Richard Rogers. She says, "I think the table and food is for conversation and contact." So welcome, Ruth Rogers. If it's about conversation and contact with other people, how important is the actual meal?
Oh, the meal is crucial. You know, we're chefs, we're every minute thinking about the food on the plate, but most of all the cooking. And people do very private things in a very public space. But if it's centered around a very good meal, then I think that definitely is the crucial factor.
I'd never thought about what you just said about people doing very private things in a very public space. That's an interesting dynamic.
And if you ask waiters, it's fascinating. But one of my favorite stories was about a man who told us he was going to propose to his girlfriend, and it said, "Would you please write, 'Will you marry me?' on the cake?" So we did. And halfway through the meal, he came up and said, "Please cancel the cake."
Ooh.
I know. So we were I always wondered what happened, you know, what happened in the first course.
Your restaurant has spawned so many imitators, not to mention a generation of chefs who've gone on to populate kitchens, not just in Britain, but around the world. What rules do you hope that they learned at your stove that they are executing in their kitchens?
That's a good question. People say to me sometimes, "What talent do you look for in a chef?" And I say, well, it's not just the talent to cook. It's a talent to work with another person on the team. It's a talent to teach. It's a talent to accept criticism. It's a talent to, of course, be neat and clean, and that you treat people with respect. I think Rose and I really wanted to run a kitchen through hope rather than fear. I love being in the kitchen. You know, since the death of Rose, there's been a lot more work to do. But if I ever lose my context of being in the kitchen, then I'm finished. I want to be there. I want to be with the chefs.
It's time for some music now, Ruth Rogers. What are we going to hear?
Now you will hear the recording again.
My castaway this week is the chef and restaurateur Ruth Rogers. The River Cafe, the culinary institution she heads, is revered by foodies and chefs the world over and has been going strong for more than a quarter of a century. Along with her dear friend and business partner, the late Rose Gray, she rewrote not just the menu, but also the rulebook of what it means to dine out well. Forget glossy reductions, timbales or sugar-spun nests, and think instead of the very finest ingredients prepared with rustic sentiment and unyielding rigour, served up in a minimalist space in a decidedly unglamorous part of town. She is by nature a perfectionist, sleeping overnight in far-flung Italian bakeries to better understand how loaves are made, or traipsing the length and breadth of the same country every November to find just the right olive oil to drizzle on wood-roasted turbot or chopped raw veal. Her Michelin star and cult status are all the more impressive, given that she never set out to be a chef. She arrived from America at the tail end of the 60s, studying graphic art and falling in love with a young architect who would later go on to design her now world-renowned restaurant. His name was Richard Rogers. She says, "I think the table and food is for conversation and contact. So welcome, Ruth Rogers. If it's about conversation and contact with other people, how important is the actual meal?
Oh, the meal is crucial. You know, we're chefs, we're every minute thinking about the food on the plate, but most of all, the cooking. And people do very private things in a very public space. But if it's centered around a very good meal, then I think that definitely is the crucial factor.
I'd never thought about what you just said about people doing very private things in a very public space. That's an interesting dynamic.
And if you ask waiters, it's fascinating. But one of my favorite stories was about a man who told us he was going to propose to his girlfriend, and it said, "Would you please write, 'Will you marry me?' on the cake." So we did. And halfway through the meal, he came up and said, "Please cancel the cake."
Ooh.
I know. So we were I always wondered what happened, you know, what happened in the first course.
Your restaurant has spawned so many imitators, not to mention a generation of chefs who've gone on to populate kitchens, not just in Britain, but around the world. What rules do you hope that they learned at your stove that they are executing in their kitchens?
That's a good question. People say to me sometimes, "What talent do you look for in a chef?" And I say, well, it's not just the talent to cook. It's a talent to work with another person on the team. It's a talent to teach. It's a talent to accept criticism. It's a talent to, of course, be neat and clean, and that you treat people with respect. I think Rose and I really wanted to run a kitchen through hope rather than fear. I love being in the kitchen. You know, since the death of Rose, there's been a lot more work to do. But if I ever lose my context of being in the kitchen, then I'm finished. I want to be there. I want to be with the chefs.
It's time for some music now, Ruth Rogers. What are we going to hear?
This is the end of Section B.
Siamo alla conclusione della prova d'ascolto d'inglese. Smettete di scrivere. Chiudete la prova d'esame e posatela sull'urlo del banco insieme alla scheda di valutazione. Ancora un cordiale saluto.